Begin episode 252.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is brought to you by our special prairie correspondent. It's about poverty, people, and human dignity. Let's listen.
I think it's important to reveal I live in a small city on the prairies because my experience, given the location, would, I imagine, be differently perceived by those in big cities, as encounters such as the following would probably be more frequent in a metropolitan center, and that the rarity of my experience caused me to do more self-questioning than I ever imagined. I'm middle-old and have lived a pretty normal middle-class life. I say this because with my upbringing, I would have thought I might have agreed with the solution to this problem, but I was surprised by my reaction. Having said all this, I came away from this occurrence a much more cynical person than I thought myself capable. More cynical of myself, my moralities, my obligations to, and my fear of my own species. On with it then, shall I? A few days back at a large retail outlet, I saw a greatly disturbing sight. While my husband was paying for our groceries, I chose to wait on the entrance side of the checkouts, where there were two benches placed for convenience. As I approached the benches, there was a man seated. While he was asleep, he was in no one's way. He was sitting upright, his feet were well away from the traffic that passed in front of him. Although his clothes were well worn, he appeared clean, his hair was combed, but it was evident he was in a less than desirable place in his life. I guess that's why I took notice of him. As I said, he was not bothering the customers. He was asleep. While I was there, two other men who were customers sat down next to him on the second of the two benches. Obviously, they had no qualms. After a cursory glance, they just sat down by him. It was been rather cold this April in our province, and no doubt they thought, as I did, that this man was tired and cold. And what harm was it that he sat a while in a warm store? I cannot stress enough, this man was causing no trouble whatsoever. Zero. Now, here comes the problem. A member of the staff took it upon themselves to rudely rouse this man from his rest and order him to leave. The male staff member in turn poked aggressively and then retreated, only to poke at the man and again retreat, as if he was afraid of catching some dreaded ailment, all the while shouting, "You have to leave. You're sleeping. Get out." I couldn't help but take exception to this treatment. Because of the jabbing, the man awoke startled, as would anyone in the same position. He then quietly stood, jammed his hands in his pockets, and left the store. I never felt so sad. As he was walking to the exit, I'd noticed he'd left his backpack on the bench. I grabbed it up and raced out after him. After catching up to him, I asked, "Is this your backpack?" And he looked at me and answered yes, and then said thank you. The interaction took seconds, but in that short space of time our eyes made contact, and I saw such a sorrowful look in his. I mumbled, "You're welcome," and scurried away. I say scurry because all of a sudden I was fearful of having too much contact. Would he ask something of me if I stayed there a moment longer? How can we treat our fellow humans with such disdain? I assure you, I was not the only customer that disapproved of the ignorance shown this man. Would it really have done such a harm to allow him to rest a while longer? I could see if he was panhandling, creating a disturbance, laying all over the bench. He wasn't even snoring. As I continued on my way, my thoughts were of this man. How could I have helped him? Should I have given him money, bought him a bite to eat? Couldn't see me doing that. I'm not the outgoing sort. But if I did, what good would it do? It would only be a stopgap, and nothing long-lasting. I certainly wasn't prepared to intrude, intervene. After all, I didn't know him, what his situation was. If I gave him money, how much? What would he do with it? So many things went through my mind. Did he even want any help? Who was I to presume he would receive my concern, or was it pity? Was he trustworthy? Dangerous? Initially, after this encounter, although saddened by his treatment, I felt good because I had done something. After all, I'd given back his backpack. Would he have ever gotten it back? It was heavy and probably carried his worldly goods. I don't know, and I will never know. A chance encounter, an instant in time. And then I thought, whoop-dee-doo, what a big sacrifice I had made. I could have done so much more if I was willing to take a chance. The whole world is full of such chance meetings. Every day people come upon others in all types of circumstance. Very few do anything that can make a positive change for those in need. Like me, seeing the injustice, wanting to help, but afraid. Afraid of making that personal contact with a vulnerable, needy stranger. I remember one time I was on my way to a fall supper and a small cat came eagerly around the people going into the hall as well as trying to dive through the door. At each attempt it was scooted away. It looked scruffy and thin. I sensed it was very hungry and was made frantic with the smell of food. It seemed so desperate. During the meal with the cat on my mind, I kept some meat aside with the intentions of feeding it outside. When I gave it the food, I didn't even have time to take the napkin off. The cat devoured the whole thing. I found that so much easier to deal with than I did the man in the store. I guess it's the separation between animal and man. Animals are happy with what we choose to give them, however meager, and we find it easier to provide. Human interactions are not so clear or simple. When I got home, I decided to email the business in question and get some feedback from them. Well, they were really concerned. I'm being sarcastic here. I received a form reply stating how important my shopping experience was to them, and they strive to improve customer service on a daily basis. Thank you very much for my input, and if I have any questions, please be sure to let them know. I might as well have been complaining about the price of onions. So, what of it, you may ask? And that, sadly, is what I find I'm asking myself. We supposedly live in a civilized nation, and yet we demean people who sleep on benches. We have people who need to sleep on benches. It is a sad state of affairs that people, and I include myself here, that we find it easier to help a stray animal than a stray person. I think what made me want to share this experience was not that we need more help for those in need, but what I learned about myself. That as indignant as I was at this poor man's plight, the reluctance I felt to help, the guilt I felt at that reluctance, the dismay I feel at living in a country where it seems poverty, reluctance, and guilt find such a comfortable home, while so many find no home at all. Thanks for listening. This is Del McClinigan, Radio Free Thinkers, Prairie Correspondents, and folks, let's try and make tomorrow better than today.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. There's been a bit of a to-do here in the West Coast that has brought on the calls of the language police. And no, it's not the Francophones this time that are raising the red flag, but us Anglos. There have been a number of signs appearing in places like bus stops that are unilingual. And the language is not one of the official languages, English or French, but Chinese. This issue is, I think, is relatively unique to Canada. As a nation, we have, since the 1980s, committed our national identity to multiculturalism. That sounded great when the white English majority, or French majority in Quebec, well, they were the majority. Now that parts of the country, in this case Richmond, BC, are actually majority Chinese, this multiculturalism thing may not seem like such a good idea, or at least it makes some people uncomfortable. It is, I think, human nature to get that feeling And I'm sure we've all felt it at one time or another when you hear someone talk in a language you don't understand. Maybe they coincidentally look in your direction. You hear laughter. Well, you think they're talking about you. On one level, you know it's nuts. But in a more primitive, emotional way, you still feel it. I think rationally, most people in Canada believe in free speech. We don't have an ideological problem with advertising in a single language, even if it's not one of the official languages. For years, when I went into a Chinese herbalist shop, the only thing I could understand was the pricing. All the signs were in Chinese, so this isn't really a new thing. Why this latest usage has gained legs is because the other signage was in the shop and not in public. I was invading their space. There's kind of a social understanding that when I walked into the shop, a very Chinese shop in the case of an herbalist, well, they were catering to a focused clientele. And if I felt like a foreigner, well, in an odd way, I was. So when Crest, and I think it was Crest that put up the advertisement aimed at the Chinese community, they were, in a legal, logical kind of way, allowed or permitted to use Chinese exclusively. But when the sign was put into a public place, well, it's in everyone's face. It reversed the herbal shop sentiment because now they, in quotes, are invading our space, my space. And perhaps another social convention was violated, that of inclusiveness, also a hallmark of multiculturalism. It has been, rightly or wrongly, seen by some in the English community as a, forgive the pun, a sign of exclusivity, that as English speakers, we are not welcome here. Although I can understand that sentiment again, emotively, does the reverse hold true? Should all signs in Richmond also have Chinese on it, or Punjabi in Surrey? Where this story went left was when one of the proponents of English on all signs was a Chinese city councillor. At first, you might think that kind of weird. Should he not sort of support his own? Sorry, that sounds kind of racist, but I'm unsure how else to put it. However, if you break it down, it's not actually that weird. One lesson we have learned in our multicultural experiment is that majoritarian cultures, typically English or French, must make allowances for minority cultures so as to allow them to both flourish and feel as if they're part of the quilt that is Canada. So, as Chinese are the majority in Richmond, it seems logical that this councilman will be conciliatory to the minority. It's the first time that the minority is the English. Well, okay, that's not true. If we lived in Quebec, we've been through this before, but that's a separate story. And maybe that's why the story has garnered such attention. On both sides, there's a fear of the language police that those outside of Quebec see as sort of authoritarian and unjust or just plain wrong. When we contrast this situation with Quebec, we get some uncomfortable parallels. I am sure part of the conciliatory attitude of the councillor is to placate the backlash from the English community, who are still the vast majority in the province. The last thing he or Richmond or myself want is to see provincial legislation mandating language rules. On the English side, the whole idea of language police just has a bad taste in its mouth, sort of thanks to Quebec. So, we have the first of what is likely to be more and more linguistically focused advertising. If it is effective advertising, it will continue, and those of us who feel uncomfortable may just have to accept what multiculturalism ultimately means, a majority of none. We'll return after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
There's been a lot in the news lately about the Temporary Foreign Workers Program. either how foreign workers are stealing our jobs, employers are robbing the temporary workers, or just how it's a big middle finger to Canadian labor. What's wrong with the program? Nothing, except its execution. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem in principle for the idea of temporary foreign workers, provided they are of a certain type. For example, if Stephen Colbert wanted to work for the CBC, I think an exception to the regular green card type system should be used. This principle may apply to areas such as doctors, academics, etc. There is a common theme to all of these. These are people who have unique skills. They occupy jobs that cannot be competently supplied by local talent. What do I mean by local talent? Well, we have a quota system on the graduation of doctors in the country. So supplementing that supply with qualified foreign help helps our healthcare system to ensure that everyone has a doctor to visit. Where the system breaks down is when unskilled workers are imported to suppress the job market. What do I mean by suppress? Well, if you're a Tim Hortons in northern BC, you can't find people to work for $10.25 an hour. Well, you have two choices. One, you can offer 12 or 14 or whatever dollars an hour. This is how capitalism works, if we believe in the market system. It's the whole idea of supply and demand. Of course, another option is to suppress the wages of labor by importing workers from foreign countries who are not only willing to work for the minimum wage, but even less. In fact, as recent allegations have pointed out, these workers are not only willing to work for less than the minimum wage, but they are far more vulnerable to employer abuse. Accusations such as unpaid overtime, forced to attain accommodation from and pay exorbitant rents to the employer, penalties for talking to each other, and even if workers dare to complain, they run the risk of having their worker visa withdrawn by the very employer they're complaining about. Temporary foreign workers, under these conditions, unskilled or low labor, are virtual slaves to their importer employer. This is what has happened to the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. There are really two main problems with the program as it now exists, both of which are easy and simply remedied. First, the scope of who can apply to the program is way too expansive. As we have learned in the last several weeks, there is no conceivable reason a Tim Hortons or a McDonald's needs to import workers. Why these companies are allowed to participate in this program leads to the second main problem with the program. You see, when a company makes an application to import workers, it must apply for a labor market opinion from Human Resource and Skills Development Canada. This opinion is supposed to assess the level of unemployment in a region and a job sector. Based on this, an employer can say that there is insufficient labor and therefore they need to import workers. And it is this labor market opinion that is at the root of the rot of the program. First, there is the methodology used. It seems odd, perhaps even suspicious, that the numbers arrived at in the opinion are not the same as those from other government agencies such as StatsCan. Reports have shown that instead of relying on traditional numbers, the opinion bases its numbers on things like Kijiji and Craigslist. Although innovative in some ways, these are far from an accurate measure. But why would they short-circuit the investigatory process? Well, there's been a general reduction of staffing across government departments. Those who remain must either find a way to make 48-hour days fit into 24-hour days, or they have to take shortcuts. Like instead of delving deep into statistical data from Stats Canada, you just do a Google search. Other factors is the time the labor market opinion takes. The Temporary Foreign Workers Program is 4 decades old. It used to take 5 months to get the opinion. Since the Harper government has taken over, it's now about 5 days. How is anyone supposed to do an appropriate assessment? And remember, part of the assessment is to ensure that the applying employer has made a serious and extensive effort to hire locally. So, not only does the civil servant look at the application, have to assess whether there is a labor shortage in a region and sector, but that the company actually has made an effort to hire locally. Who has the time? Now, for a program that has been around for as long as it has, it is only recently that such issues have been raised. And I should point out that the program does provide a service to Canada when people play by the rules. The government will make the claim that the abuses that have been recently brought to light are perpetrated by employers who broke the rules. and they would be right. But the only way these employers could break the rule is thanks to a government that does not believe it needs to provide oversight of its own programs. You cannot find cheaters if you're not looking for them. And this government has made a concerted effort to not look. Anything from loosening regulations, reduction of government employees who are tasked to provide oversight, to the reduction of funding to oversight operations, hampering their ability to do their job. It appears most of the investigations to date were complaint-driven, complaints made by employees with the nerve enough to come forward. That is, if these issues were not brought to the attention of the government, well, again, the government didn't want to know. As well, when complaints were made by imported workers, well, as I said before, they lose their jobs. They may face deportation while their complaint is being investigated, a distinctive disincentive for reporting wrongdoing. The suspension of the temporary foreign worker program for the food service industry will be a band-aid. The government will announce a review of the process. A report will be released in a few weeks or months. Quietly, the suspension will be lifted. The government will say they fixed the problem, and we can await another few months when the horror stories will once again fill the headlines. This government will not fix the problem because it does not want to. It does not serve the people of Canada, but its corporations. Never forget 2015. We'll be back after this break.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
And we're back. Well, it's the 28th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear explosion. It was the worst nuclear disaster in human history. As a result of the explosion, 42 people died directly from radiation exposure. Well, it has been estimated that 27,000 others have died due to increased cancer rates. To put this into perspective, though, this is less than 1,000 deaths per year. Well, 13,000 people die each year in the U.S. alone due to pollution from coal-powered plants. But this isn't a rant about coal or nuclear power. But I happened upon a couple of articles about life in the exclusion zone. The exclusion zone is a 2,600 kilometer square no-man's zone. If you look online, you will see as many photos of abandoned cities in the region that have given the region a really spooky kind of look. Well, the articles were about life in the zone. Not human life, but wildlife. It seems that what was a disaster for humans was a boon for animals. This particular part of the former Soviet Union was heavily exploited for agriculture. One creature that was the focus of one of the articles and a documentary was the wolf. During the time of humans, the wolf was ruthlessly attacked and killed or driven to near extinction in the area. However, since the explosion and the departure of man, the wolf populations rebounded. Part of the purpose of the study was to assess the health of these radioactive wolves. And they are slightly radioactive. Well, it turns out that compared to their cousins in the normal forest regions, well, they're just healthy. There was a worry that the region could not support as large a population of wolves as their non-contaminated partners, but apparently it can. There were fears that the rate of birth defects and mortality due to cancers and other side effects of radiation exposure would be high, but they appear to be comparable between the two populations. Now, this study was rather extensive, but there's still more study needs to be done. As I mentioned, their fur is considered to be a source of radioactive contamination, so you gotta think there's gotta be something there. But it seems that living in a radioactive wasteland, at least for the wolves, is not as bad as one would think. In fact, in the documentary, they noted that field mice set up for the investigation of long-term effects of low-level radiation exposure, well, they only experienced a 4% increase in birth defects, lower than you'd think. They also pointed out that the catfish that now thrive in the pools around the reactors are huge compared to what they were when people fished the waterways regularly. And by huge, I mean naturally huge. We're not talking like Godzilla-sized fish. That said, when they went to investigate some fish carcasses left behind by birds that were feeding on the fish, they noted that touching the bones was not an option as they were too radioactive. I suspect that these fish, which lived right next door to the reactor and experienced some of the highest exposure rates, well, these fish may be thriving, but not without major ill effects, such as birth defects and the like. And if I may take a little bit of literary license, I find it ironic that, at least from the fish's perspective, a radioactive wasteland is a lot better than, quote, a healthy human settlement. This leads into the next article that talked about the health of birds in the region. As it turns out, there are about 16 different species of birds that were studied, and only two of them suffered from the low levels of radiation exposure that they experienced living in this no-man zone. First, I should explain why living in low-level radioactive zones could be damaging to your health. As it turns out, low-level radiation creates free radicals in your body. These are the buggers that damage your cells and your DNA. Free radicals are technically any molecule that has an electron removed and not in a way that it wanted. You see, atoms and molecules like to have a neutral charge. That is, all the pluses and minuses equal to zero. But a beta particle from radioactive decay can strip out one of the electron. This has the effect of making what we now call a free radical very reactive. It wants to balance its equation, and it will do anything, so it will bind with whatever it can, and that includes RNA and DNA, thus leading to cancers at all. Now, it is true that we are bombarded every day with ionizing radiation. That's the kind that makes free radicals. Not to the levels of radioactive wastelands, but still enough that life has evolved certain defenses. Our natural defense, and I hate to use the term on our show because it is so abused by purveyors of woo, but yes, oxidants soak up the free radicals and prevent them from damaging our cells. Returning to the birds, well, 14 of the species seem to have found a way to deal with the low levels of radiation. And what was even more fascinating is how these birds could do it. It turns out that an adaptation to radioactive exposure, most birds ramped up their production of oxidants. Oh yeah, and the two bird species that didn't adapt, well, it appears the chemicals needed to make the oxidants are also the ones needed to make sort of the colors in their feathers, like reds and browns. So birds with colors that had this in their plumage are those that couldn't reduce them in their plumage. Well, they couldn't ramp up their production of oxidant, whereas the other ones could ramp up their production of oxidants at the expense of depleting the colors in their feathers. To show that this is an adaptive or evolutionary change, mortality rates compared to Chernobyl and Fukushima showed that birds were dying at greater rates at Fukushima. But this is believed to be because the birds around Chernobyl have had longer to adapt to the increased radioactive exposure. On a side note, it had been noted that birds living in radioactive areas such as Chernobyl were reported to have a washed out sort of look, like their plumage had faded. As it turned out, that was true. By reducing the amount of color they produced in the feathers, the birds could use those chemicals to produce more oxidants and thus live healthier lives. The takeaway from that? Well, anecdotes are great, but it's only when they are backed up by real science that they become real things.
How do you know they're all female? Does somebody go out in the park and pull up the dinosaur skirts?
We control their chromosomes. It's really not that difficult. All vertebrate embryos are inherently female anyway. They just require an extra hormone given at the right developmental stage to make them male. We simply deny them that.
Deny them that?
John, the kind of control you're attempting is
It's not possible. Listen, if there's one thing the history of evolution has taught us, it's that life will not be contained. Life breaks free, it expands to new territories, and it crashes through barriers painfully, maybe even dangerously, but... there it is.
There it is.
You're implying that a group composed entirely of female animals will breed?
No, I'm simply saying that life finds a way.
We'll return after this break.
How you feeling? Ah! Feel all right?
CITR presents DJing 101.9. We offer people a way to learn about the fun of mixing, sharing music, and throwing events. Our workshops and studio access is free for students and members. No experience or turntables are necessary. Workshops from 4 to 8 p.m. are on Tuesdays in 212A in the Student Union Building at UBC. For more information, visit us at citr.ca or follow at citrdj on Twitter.
And we're back. Okay, there's been a lot of talk and fear-mongering and just plain confusion over the idea of GMOs. We have talked before about GMOs, but more tangentially or related to articles here or there. So I thought today we would take a complete rundown on the issue. To start with, we should define what we mean by GMOs. Well, the acronym stands for genetically modified organism. Okay, I know what genes are. They're the building blocks of life, your DNA. And I know, roughly speaking, what an organism is. Something that is alive and reproduces. Okay, we could argue about what is life, but this should suffice for our conversation. Then things get a little fuzzy when we try to define modified. First, nature itself is a great genetic experimenter. The whole primary axiom of evolution is based upon genetic modification. Granted, this is largely done via natural mutations that arise from miscopied DNA, cosmic rays, chemical toxins, all that have the power to mutate our genes, quote, naturally. Important note there, naturally. Of course, you can also get a bit of gene splicing via bacteria, and you can also get hybrids. By hybrids, I mean when you have, as recently happened, a donkey and a zebra breed to produce a zonkey. You can get the same thing when a lion and a tiger, a grizzly or a polar bear, and hard to believe you can get a wolpin when a false killer whale and a dolphin has conjugal or commingling, you know, they get it on. Of course, this is natural, and we have no issues with this, although if you think about it, natural genetic manipulation also created the Black Death, smallpox, nightshade, poison ivy, the black widow spider, and the cobra. So let's not all fall into the naturalistic fallacy that just because it's, quote, natural, it must be good. It's not necessarily so. But not all of this type of genetic modification we can lay at the feet of nature. Humanity, over its millions of years, well, okay, at least the last tens of thousands of years of agriculture, have been modifying life forms to serve our own purposes. The banana is probably the best example. If you look at a natural wild banana, well, they are small, they have large seeds, and a little bitter to the taste. But humans, via selective breeding, each generation planted seeds from only those plants that were preferred or that were conductive to human contact. So the banana was likely an intentional modification, but most scientists believe the first grains were not intentionally domesticated, as the plants learned that if they could use humans to disperse their seeds, they could have better reproductive success. Of course, modern agriculture is very much directed reproduction. In fact, and it feels weird to call this natural, but one tactic scientists have used to create beneficial mutations in plants is by purposely irradiating them or exposing them to known carcinogens. Using these techniques, the next generation of plants have, random, but a greater number of genetic mutations. The hope is that some of these will have beneficial properties, maybe resistance to pathogens, or a greater resistance to water stress, whatever. But these are still seen as natural, even though I'm not sure if they really qualify as natural. So now let's move on to what is the big bugaboo about GMO, the kind of modification that's done in a lab where genes are inserted into an organism. You may not be aware, but there are two types of gene splicing, intraspecies and interspecies. Interspecies gene splicing is where you take the genes from one plant and implant them into another plant of the same species or family. So essentially, you are speeding up crossbreeding. In fact, this is so much more precise than crossbreeding, because crossbreeding exchanges many genes, and we have no control over what genes are transferred. Interspecies gene splicing is much more precise, removing only a single segment and implanting it into another host. This is like the safest of all ways to modify the DNA. It is a trait that is well understood and is only one trait that is being transferred. Now, this is also a great source of hope for people who suffer from a great number of metabolic diseases. One of the greatest hopes for the coming century is gene therapy. Gene therapy promises to cure genetically based diseases such as cystic fibrosis, hemophilia, muscular dystrophy, sickle cell anemia, and others. This is a kind of cross between inter and intra-splicing. Why? Because although the gene being transferred is a human gene, the vector, or the actual agent doing the transferring, is a modified virus. Why a virus? Well, first, the raison d'etre is to inject DNA into a cell. Second, the idea of gene therapy is to replace the defective genes found in the afflicted with properly functioning copies of the DNA. You don't want to change just a single cell, but you actually want to change many cells. Non-viral gene splicing is intended to change a single cell, like an egg cell. But gene therapy, you must change many cells in a living body. To date, only one therapy treatment has been approved for general use, but dozens of others are likely to be approved in the near future. Okay, so now we shall discuss the Frankenfood in the room. Why do they use the word Frankenfood? Well, first, it evokes irrational fear, but it's also related to the other type of gene splicing, intraspecies. Intraspecies gene splicing takes a gene from one organism, let's say a flounder, and implants that into another, let's say a tomato. Why? Well, it seems that flounders produce an anti-freezing protein. Once inserted to the tomatoes, it will increase its resistance to frost. Although this is the poster child of the anti-GMO crowd, this product was actually never commercialized. Another cause celeb is BT-enhanced crops. BT is short for Bacillus thuringiensis. This bacteria produces a toxin that kills bugs. This gene has been introduced to corn, among other crops. The BT protein basically turns a caterpillar's guts into Swiss cheese. Now, one might argue that if this protein makes Swiss cheese of a caterpillar's guts, might it not do the same to a human? Well, no. In a simplistic way, we might think that a toxin for one animal is a toxin to all animals. And this is not true. In fact, there are very few universal toxins. So BT is only toxic to a small class of insects. Think about chocolate. Humans love chocolate. Chocolate is very good. Give me more chocolate. But it can kill your dog. So toxic is not toxic to all. Only the fearmongers make such misplaced claims. One thing that is often overlooked by the GMO crowd is the fact that most GMOs are good for the environment. The BT-enhanced corn means that farmers need not administer pesticides that would not only kill the bugs that eat the corn, but all bugs, including monarch butterflies. Don, you might say, that's a weird segue. What's up with monarch butterflies? Well, this is another case of a false flag fear-mongering. You see, some people would state that BT corn, well, it is killing the butterflies and the bees. Okay, I just threw that last one in just because. Well, as it turns out, monarch butterflies don't eat corn. They eat milkweed plants. It also seems that their population decline has been going on for decades, that it is more likely that the loss of habitat, reduction of milkweed population, and parasitism is the real cause for the decline. Now, be aware, there are a few, but only a few, discredited studies that support the idea that BT kills butterflies. And this exemplifies my problem with the whole anti-GMO issue. We could blame BT corn for the decline of the monarch butterfly, or we could address the real problem, deforestation. No, we will demonize corn while the butterflies become extinct regardless. Okay, so that's how we modify organisms. Of course, the current issue revolves around mainly the last type, but only in a very specific instance, our food. There has been much work in genetically modifying bacteria to mass produce spider silk to be used for a host of different applications. Pigs, mice, and other animals have been enhanced, if I may feign immodesty as a humanoid, with human DNA to do everything from study diseases to improve the compatibility of organ transplants. I have heard little, if any, complaint about mosquitoes that have been modified to eradicate malaria, dengue fever, and other tropical diseases that the pest may carry. People seem okay when a bacteria is modified to digest toxic waste, be it oil, plastics, or even radioactive waste. Cows have been modified to produce human breast milk. Pigs have been modified so as to reduce the amount of phosphorus runoff. Phosphorus pollutes our waterway and results in massive die-offs of fish to what scientists call oceanic dead zones because nothing with the exception of algae can live in them. No, it seems these are okay to the anti-GMO groups. The only time they complain is when we're talking about our food. Well, okay, that's not a small thing. It is true that GMOs are most evident in our lives when it comes to food, and I've often railed that we must carefully pick our battles. And that is why I'm against GMO labeling. It creates a false sense of fear that is not substantiated in any of the non-corporate independent research. The anti-GMO advocates often ignore the scientific evidence saying it is all paid for by big biotech companies. And it is true they spend a lot of money in research in the same way that big oil pushes back against climate change. And if that was the only source of information, they would have a point. But they manipulate and misrepresent the scientific consensus on GMO in the precisely same way that climate change denialists do. And I think the real battle here is not against the science of genetic modification, but the corporate control of agriculture. What they hate is Monsanto, Cargill, and how they dominate the grain market, how they use their corporate oligarchy to manipulate government regulations. I think it's immoral that a corporation, or anyone, can have a patent on a gene. Life is life and life is meant to be free. That is wrong to me, and we should fight that. We should ensure proper regulations to ensure that mega corporations like Monsanto can't do the bad things that they're doing, such as monocrops, that we plant the exact same kind of crop everywhere in the world. One small genetic modification in a particular disease could literally wipe out most of the food on this planet. Those are the things that we should be worrying about. If anti-GMO people were calling for a corporate labeling system on food, I'd be all for that. And there is an irony. The reason that the Monsantos of the world don't want GMO labeling is not because they want to poison and kill millions with their supposed toxic foods, but they know that GMO has become a marketing negative, that they would lose sales because the anti-GMOs have made the word toxic, even though the product is not. By lobbying against GMO labeling, it looks like they have something to hide when they're only really worried about market share. Perhaps the best thing is that GMO labeling happens. But I have to say that a large, well-funded campaign must take place at the same time to educate the public about the realities of GMO, not only on our food shelves, but the good they do in the environment and for humanity in general. We're going to end today's show with a bit of wisdom from the web. Well, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you live in the United States, you almost certainly consume a genetically modified organism or GMO on a daily basis. Maybe it's the sugar beets that were used to make the sugar in the cookie you're eating, or the mayo on the sandwich made from GM soybeans in yesterday's hamburger. I can almost guarantee it was produced by a cow that ate GM corn. Before long, we'll be eating entire genetically modified animals. In 2012, the FDA gave its okay for a new kind of Atlantic salmon engineered to have higher levels of growth hormone using the genes of Pacific salmon and an eel-like fish called the ocean pout. It's the first GM animal to be approved for human consumption. GMOs are everywhere, pretty much literally. 95% of sugar beets, 88% of corn, and 94% of soybeans grown in the U.S. contain traits like being insect-resistant or herbicide-resistant that were engineered into them. Still, creating GMOs for food is incredibly expensive and time-consuming, and their impacts on the environment and on human health are largely unknown. So some countries, most recently Peru and Russia, have banned their import and use, because people tend to not like unknowns, especially if you're eating them. But even though a lot remains unknown, there's still plenty you need to understand, like what GMOs really are, how they're made, and what we do and don't know about them so far. The term genetically modified organism is actually something of a misnomer itself. I mean, people have been genetically modifying plants and animals since the invention of agriculture. Every plant and animal species has natural genetic variability, and for thousands of years, we've harnessed this variability by practicing artificial selection. We cultivate and breed organisms to emphasize their most desirable traits. Cows that produce more milk, squash plants that survive drought when other plants die. But when we talk about GMOs today, what we're actually talking about is genetically engineered organisms. This involves laboratories and processes in which the genes from one species are extracted and put into the genes of a different species. This is called transgenesis. And though not all GMO food is created this way, transgenic crops are by far the most common kind of genetically engineered organisms you come across. So we should probably be calling them GEOs, but let's not get hung up on label. The thing is, engineered organisms aren't anything new either. We've been tinkering with food in laboratories for nearly 100 years. In the 1920s, scientists realized that they could cause mutations in plants, thereby creating more genetic diversity and more possibly desirable traits by exposing them to X-rays and gamma rays and various chemicals. Through the 1970s, these methods of mutation breeding were quite popular. Then, in 1983, scientists pioneered a new tactic when they successfully took a gene from an antibiotic-resistant bacterium and spliced it into the DNA of a tobacco plant. That new drug-resistant tobacco didn't have any real purpose, it just proved that we could insert bacterial genes into plants. The new practice of transgenics was born. But the GM industry as we know it today really took off in 1994 when the USDA approved something called the Flavor Saver tomato, a fruit invented by a California biotech company that was altered so that it took longer to ripen, giving it a longer shelf life. It was the first genetically modified crop sold to consumers. But the Flavor Saver didn't last very long, partly because the flavor it was saving wasn't quite as good, and partly because others, mainly in Europe, were suspicious of its genetic alterations. Today, most GMOs aren't found in your produce section like the Flavor Saver was. Instead, more than 90% of commercially grown GM foods are commodity crops. Staples like feed corn and soybeans, which have been modified to resist herbicides or insects. These crops are used to make lots of ingredients in processed foods that we eat or are used as fodder for animals that we later enjoy as a beef Wellington or nice turkey club sandwich. Probably the most well-known of these GMO crops are so-called Roundup Ready crops, foods like soybean, corn, sugar beets, cotton, alfalfa, and canola that are engineered to resist the herbicide brand known as Roundup. These crops provide us with some, you might say, digestible examples of how GMO foods are engineered, why they're made the way they are, what they do, as well as what they don't do. Let's start with why they were made in the first place. The active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup is glyphosate, a chemical that inhibits an enzyme plants use to synthesize amino acids. By blocking this enzyme, Roundup stops plants from making what they need to grow and metabolize food, thereby killing them. And it pretty much takes no prisoners, so much so that it can be hard to use around plants that you don't want to kill. So, in the early 1990s, the company that makes Roundup, called Monsanto, decided to develop crops that were resistant to glyphosate, so that farmers could spray the herbicide over their whole crop, but only kill the weeds. What the scientists discovered is that there are microorganisms that produce an enzyme that's unaffected by glyphosate. They realized that if they could transfer those bacteria's properties into the food plants, farmers could use more Roundup without killing their crops. So they extracted small pieces of bacterial DNA that were responsible for making this enzyme and set about introducing them into plants. But how do you get the genes from a bacterium into the nucleus of a plant cell? On the tree of life, plants and bacteria aren't even on the same branch. Well, it turns out that there are a couple of pretty interesting ways. The first involves gene guns. Yeah, you heard me right. Gene guns do pretty much what they sound like, literally, and kind of haphazardly blasting DNA into plant cells. Most commonly used to engineer corn and rice species, they start with tiny particles of gold that are coated with hundreds of copies of a desirable donor gene called transgene. Cells from the plant that's gonna receive the new genes are put in a vacuum chamber and then fire away. The gene-covered gold particles are shot at the cells using a high-pressure gas. Once inside the nucleus of a plant cell, the gold dissolves and the scientists cross their fingers and hope that the DNA is taken up by the chromosomes in the nucleus, which it sometimes is. Once the transgenes have been incorporated into the plant's DNA, it can be bred into offspring plants. Another more recent and more effective way to create transgenic organisms involves using a soil-dwelling bacterium called Agrobacterium. This is a plant parasite and a natural genetic engineer. It has an extra and quite special piece of DNA called a plasmid that can move outside the bacterium and implant itself into a plant cell. In nature, the agrobacterium uses this little trick to recode the plant cells to actually grow food for it. But in the lab, engineers can use the plasmid as a kind of carrier for fancy transgenes, using it to infuse plant cells with new genetic material. So whether you use the agrobacterium or the gene guns, you now have a new engineered crop plant. But you can't just put that thing in the ground. You have to introduce this new genetic material into existing traditional strains of the crop. This last step, called back crossbreeding, involves repeatedly crossing the new transgenic plant with breeding stock over and over again until you wind up with a new GMO crop. It's a long process. The whole thing can take as long as 15 years, but that's how just about all genetic engineering is done to your food, whether scientists are putting a bacterium's antibiotic resistance into a tobacco plant or an eel's growth pattern into a salmon. So because of all this technology, GMOs are out there everywhere, even though we may not know exactly where they are on our plates. Considering how prevalent GMOs are, though, at least here in the US, there are very few independent studies on the potential health and environmental effects of them. Since GMOs are patented, the research related to them is tightly controlled by their manufacturers. More research has been done in Europe, at least on whether there are any health issues associated with eating them. One study conducted at Caen University in France in 2012 linked GM corn to higher rates of cancer and organ damage in rodents. Other studies conducted in Italy in the early 2000s found that mice fed Roundup-ready soybeans produced fewer digestive enzymes and saw modifications in the nuclei of their liver cells. In the case of the liver cells, at least, the changes reversed once the mice went back to eating wild soy. But still, there's not a whole lot to go on. One thing scientists would probably agree on when it comes to GMO research is simply that there needs to be a lot more GMO research. While we're waiting for that, it seems like GM crops do have at least one thing working against them. Nature, which is managing to dilute or even undo the effects of GMOs over time. You may have heard of BT corn and BT cotton, for example. These are crops engineered to produce a protein originally found in soil bacteria that kills insects like caterpillars that eat them. They basically come with their own built-in insecticide. But researchers are already discovering that some pests have developed resistance to BT. Like, even though BT is designed to attack insects' guts, one of BT's targets, the cabbage looper caterpillar, has been found to have developed different receptors in its guts that are no longer affected by the insecticide. And Roundup-ready crops are also under attack. Already, there are more than 24 superweed species that have popped up that are resistant to Roundup, covering millions of acres in the United States. Even GMO crops themselves can become weeds. After all, there's no way of containing a crop once it's planted. Seeds were designed to travel. So in North Dakota, for instance, GM canola has escaped fields and now grows in the wild. Plus, it can easily cross with related wild and domestic species from mustard to broccoli, which then messes with the GMO plants as well as the wild plants. So even though we've learned a whole lot from nature, enough to engineer our own organisms, nature seems to stay a step ahead, at least so far. Now, what do you think about genetically modified foods? Pro, con, delicious? Let us know in the comments. And thank you for watching this episode of SciShow. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or, of course,
if you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of
it. You came to us as outlaws. You came alone in chains. All that is in the past. Here, on the wall, we are all one house.
I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. Now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I pledge my life and honor for this night and all the nights to come. Now my watch begins for this night and all the nights to come. Now my watch begins.
The Night's Watch is the only thing standing between the realm and what lies beyond. Winter is coming.
My queen, about to serve you, obey you. I know what you intend. Do not.
I must. I see the faces of slaves. I free you. Take off your collars. No one will stop you. But if you stay, it will be as brothers and sisters, as husbands and wives. I am the dragon's daughter, and I swear to you that those who would harm you will die screaming. I am the dragon's daughter,
You shall have a golden crown, men shall tremble to behold.
And I swear to you, I am the dragon's daughter.
When winter does come, gods help us all if we're not ready.
Our best hope, our only hope, is that you can defeat them in the field. If you lose, your sisters die, your father dies. Our best hope, our only hope, is that you can defeat them in the field.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
There is only one God, and his name is death.
And there is only one thing we say to death. Not today.
You help me win the Iron Throne.
We were meant to rule together.
But now winter is coming. We must protect ourselves.
Don't ask me to stand aside as you climb on that pyre. I will watch you burn.
You don't understand.
I am the dragon's daughter. And I swear to you, those who would harm you will die screaming. I am the dragon's daughter,
You shall have a golden crown, men shall tremble to behold.
And I swear to you, I am the dragon's daughter.
There's a question that troubles us all. From the time we are first able to think. And that is, where did we come from? And this question is so compelling that we've invented the science of astronomy. We've discovered these natural laws so that we can learn more about our origin and where we came from. This is what drives us. This is what we want to know. Let's keep looking. Let's keep searching. Come to be because of the universe's existence, and we are driven to pursue that, to find out where we came from. The joy of discovery, that's what drives us, and these questions are deep within us. Where did we come from? What was before the Big Bang? To us, this is wonderful and charming and compelling. This is what makes us get up and go to work every day. We are, you and I, at least one of the ways that the universe knows itself. It fills me with joy to make discoveries every day of things I had never seen before. To know that we can pursue these answers. Where did we come from?
What is a god? What is it to think of something sacred and larger than us and infinite and boundless? Human history seems to be suffused with this inclination towards a sense of the divine. We want to believe that there is something more. We've wanted to connect with this higher power, with this belief that there's something greater than ourselves, something that exceeds our capacities to understand. And we see gods everywhere, myths and metaphors, old gods, new gods, vengeful gods. They rise and fall with the ebb and flow of all civilization. For ages, ages, humankind, we've wanted to celebrate what brings us life. What is this thing that allowed us to emerge? The sun. The star. That right there is the source of all of our myths and allegories and hopes and dreams. It gave life to the world, gave birth to life. Its core burns at 10 million degrees and it consumes millions of tons of matter per second. We ourselves are made of remnants of its fallen siblings. The preconditions for our humanness, that certainly is what God is, right? Let there be light. Is larger than a million Earths, can blind you.